Hey, you know what? I was thinking about this on the drive home from work, but you know the movie The Sound of Music, when the Nazis take power in Austria during the Anschluss, and the Von Trapp family decides they can no longer bear to live in their native land, and they flee into Switzerland, and it's very heroic, right? And it's like they're standing up to, they're refusing to live under the boot of Nazi rule or whatever. But then, like, if you know anything about, like, European history in that period of time, they had a fascist government for like 4 years before the Anschluss. Like, just a different, they just weren't Nazis, they were just other fascists. And the Von Trapps were perfectly content living under that fascist regime. Which actually makes it a really different kind of story.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 2 of the Regrettable Century podcast. I'm Chris.
I'm Kevin.
And I'm Jason.
Well, we're going to be dealing with the topic of post-fascism, which is an attempt to define radical right-wing movements of the 21st century that have their roots in fascism and have some fascist characteristics, but don't resemble traditional fascism as we might know it.
Right.
We take this term from, it wasn't created by Enzo Traverso, but he's probably the most prominent person out there that's currently using it and attempting to turn it into a cohesive sort of theory. So I think if we are going to talk about what post-fascism is, it would make sense to define our terms. Like, how about we talk about what fascism is and what it's not?
Yeah, it seems like an incredibly plastic term. A lot of political labels are really floating signifiers in a lot of ways. Mean really different things to different people. But a lot of times I feel like even in more studied leftist circles, different Marxists even can mean different things by it.
Yeah, like whenever someone tells you that you can't say something, that's like fascism, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's
what
I think.
The same thing.
Or if you punch a Nazi for calling for ethnic cleansing, that is fascism, right?
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so if we want to define fascism, we can talk about what the first fascists were and what they believed and what they called for. And that would be the Italian fascists. They're the ones who coined the term fascism. So the Italian fascists came out of a split in the Socialist Party that wasn't militaristic or right-wing enough for the fascists, so they broke away and they came up with their own sort of set of beliefs, which was an amalgamation of the, you know, conservative nationalism of late post-World War I Italy with a lot of the ideas of the Socialist Party's right wing, which included a sort of marriage of all of the productive forces of Italy into a corporatist sort of structure.
Right, it's like the opposite of class struggle, but
class cooperation.
Right, but not like forgetting the notion of class, but like
right,
substituting the notion of class struggle for the notion of the aspirations of the whole nation or whatever.
What the Italian fascists called for and what they believed, and I'll just give you some highlights from their manifesto. Is initially they called for universal suffrage, proportional representation, abolition of the Senate, the upper house of parliament.
Wait, really?
Yes, this is the original the fascist manifesto published in 1919.
Uh-oh. Kevin's starting to get ideas.
this sounds great, guys. Abolition of the Senate. They had two houses of parliament. One was the upper house and one was the lower house. One of them, it like sort of like the House of Representatives and the Senate. They wanted the abolishment of the Senate, They called for a law that gave an immediate 8-hour workday for all workers, a minimum wage, which didn't exist, participation of workers' representatives in the function of industry, the same confidence in the labor unions as is given to industry executives. That right there, everything that I just told you right there, is sort of like a minimal transitional program for any sort of left-leaning government, right?
Yeah, yeah. I kept waiting for the bad part to hit.
Nationalization of armament factories? I guess that's not really bad either. A peaceful but competitive foreign policy. Anyway, so the manifesto itself, a strong progressive tax on capital, the seizure of possessions of all religious congregations, and the abolition of the bishoprics.
Oh, wow. They were anti-Catholic Church? That didn't seem very fascist for Italians.
Okay, so that's the initial fascist manifesto. But we could talk about fascism in theory and fascism in practice and how completely different those are.
There are two elements of that that are pretty critical that, you know, unexamined don't sound so bad, right? But they contain within them the sort of implicit logic of capitalism that fascism doesn't challenge, right? And one of them is that all of the sort of the magnates and tycoons and barons and whatever, they have a role to play in society, just right alongside labor, so does capital, in terms of representation. And the other one is a competitive foreign policy, and they say a peaceful one, but a competitive one. So, like, aspirations aside, if you allow capitalists to run things, and you say, "Hey, go and compete with your neighbors outside of the borders," like if you're a Marxist, right? Then there's a certain trajectory that sets you on, whether you want it to or not. And I imagine they probably weren't really worried about the trajectory.
No.
I mean, they did invade Libya.
Yeah. And Ethiopia.
Yeah, and Greece.
And Albania.
And they did make friends with Hitler.
Yeah. Okay, so talking about fascism and what you just mentioned there, the logic of capitalism being financial magnates and the owners of companies would be necessary for, you know, a healthy society. The idea that labor unions and people that sit in the boardrooms and make decisions should have equal representation, right? The idea is corporatist, and that, I think, is the economic, the thing that economically defines fascism is corporatism. And that is a cooperation of the classes, right? Where you have...
Specifically a national cooperation of the classes.
National correct? Cooperation of the classes, right. Yeah, specifically. Everything within fascism is for the greater good of the nation.
Well, then could you have a multi-ethnic national fascism?
I mean, Spain did.
Well, so Spain did in a sense, but like... You know, like I've met people who grew up learning to speak Catalan in secret because it was illegal to express a non-Castilian identity within the boundaries of Franco's Spain. So like, yeah, you're allowed to be Castilian ethnically. Like they're not going to march you off into a camp and like destroy you. Like,
that's true. I mean, I guess I was thinking more along the lines of a Nazi definition of ethnicity.
Right, but so these things are all, yeah, like Kevin said at the beginning, they're all fairly plastic or elastic or whatever. They're malleable.
I mean, there were Moorish citizens of Franco's Spain, you know.
Right. Well, and like the anti-Semitism in Spain was not official policy, and it was a place that French Jews escaped to over the Pyrenees or whatever. But like the thing that I guess makes Spain fascist is the like what they called national syndicalism, or the corporatist model of administration of the economy.
Right.
And all of the other features being the restorationist rejuvenating the soul of the nation against the degeneration of like modernism and all of the conditions of modernism, like liberal social attitudes and workers forgetting how important capitalists are, stuff like that.
That's, I think, one of the most important elements of fascism is a belief in the national regeneration, like a regeneration of the spirit and the soul of a people, of a people, you know? That is common to every fascist movement, but is most prominent in...
Right, like return to a past.
Like in Spain, the Francoists wanted a return to the glory of like Imperial Spain. In Italy, a return to the glory of the Roman Empire. In Hungary, it was, you know, a return to the glory of the Kingdom of Hungary and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, stuff like that. In Germany, a new Reich. They call back images of Barbarossa and the Parsifal. They don't even have to be real figures, or they could be figures shrouded in mystery from the ancient past that may or may not have even existed, but to the Germans, they were part of their racial identity and their national identity, and were thus meant to be emulated, you know? That exists through all the fascist movements.
That's why American fascists idolize Paul Bunyan.
Yeah.
Okay, so on top of national regeneration, another characteristic of fascism is what we just talked about, was a sort of anti-capitalism, like the idea of breaking the back of finance capital, right? And that was what the Germans used that all the time.
Well, isn't it like maybe an anti-capital -ism? So like not anti-capitalism, but an anti-capital, like an opposition to those vested with the most economic power in the conditions of a capitalist economy, rather than being opposed to the capitalist relations of production.
Exactly. I mean, there was no opposition to the capitalist relationship of production. There was opposition to modern capitalism. What capitalism had become. It was an idealized form of like sort of small business capitalism.
Well, right, isn't
shop owner capitalism.
Right.
This is why Trotsky kind of identifies it as primarily a movement of the middle classes, ground between big business and labor, like of basically being squeezed out of their perceived role in the world by the realities of like accumulation and the tendency of society to cleave into two classes that Marx describes as early as the 1840s, that like, you know, people don't want to acknowledge, because if you're not middle class, then you're most likely going to be at the bottom because the top's very small.
So within the National Socialist German Workers' Party, the Nazi Party, you had a left wing of the party that did hold what can be characterized as socialist ideas.
Right.
Like the Strasserites, who did call for what they called a German socialism, which looked a lot more like what was more radical than other types of fascist corporatism. They definitely called for workers to have a primary role in the formation of the new Germany. And for economic planning that was basically sort of like guild socialism. Mm. If you think back to the guild socialists of England in the 19th century.
And they had a sort of block of four classes kind of mentality.
And there goes all of our Maoist listeners.
Yeah, all out in one. Well, yeah, and I mean, well, yeah.
Well, just the difference for them is that was not a transitional conception of society.
Well, also, I mean, Jason's already like referring to Trotsky's descriptions of fascism as correct. So that's already like most listeners.
Hey, don't worry, I can alienate the other half by saying that the Popular Front's not like necessarily a bad idea.
No.
All right, now we have no listeners. Cool.
I'll go ahead and just throw in some Stalinist analysis of fascism, just to round things out, you know, because you gave the Trotskyist one. So the Stalinist one is anybody that disagrees with Stalin is fascist.
Look, if all you did join the Polish Social Democratic Party in the 1890s and were persecuted by Tsarist police and participated in mass strikes and carried out assassinations of officials and then lived through two revolutions and joined the Bolsheviks and then joined the Red Army and fought a war against the whites to, you know, secure the victory of the revolution, it doesn't mean you're not actually a fascist in secret. Only Stalin could know for sure.
All right. This seems like it's gotten a bit tangential. Okay, so characteristics of fascism are corporatism, sort of a national palingenesis, you know, the national rebirth. Revolutionary. Fascism is a revolutionary movement.
Right. You know? It seeks to replace the existing state with a new one.
Yes. It seeks to topple the old order and establish a new one. And that old order, in most cases, is a Republican government. It is specifically in France, the fascist movement there, and in Germany, and in Italy. The movements were all diametrically opposed to the Democratic Republic. They thought democracy was weak. They thought the Republican system of government was fatally flawed, and attempted to establish something akin to the old prestige and pomp of the monarchy with all the old reactionary elements of the monarchy swept aside.
Right. And it was also hyper-masculinist, like in every case, right? Like the every fascist movement.
Absolutely.
Like an overwhelmingly hyper-masculine movement where there's basically no room for women because in as much as it's revolutionary, it's also, it's reactionary. It seeks to reimpose sort of imagined roles of the old order.
Right.
Right, exactly. And within that as well, there is a mysticism, not within the hyper-masculinity part. This is within the palingenesis, the rebirth. There is an element of mysticism involved in the national rebirth. And in Germany, that took the form of sort of strange occultist paganism, or occultism in general was wildly popular in the Weimar era and the leading up to Nazi seizure of power. But the whole rebirth of German paganism that the SS sort of propagated was not like, it wasn't a mass movement. That would have been like an inner circle type thing, you know? So there was also a movement in Italy to sort of revive paganism, but it wasn't super popular, like Roman paganism, you know, but it wasn't super popular.
Nerds.
Generally, the mysticism is this sort of like idea of the blood of the race and the identity of the people to the land that they've farmed and lived on for centuries, that there was sort of a mystical connection to, like in Nazi, it was Blutenboden, you know, blood and soil. The idea that the German people had a spiritual connection to the land and a right to all of the historic German lands. And if you're into Aryan mysticism, you can expand that land as far as you want to, you know, anywhere that anyone ever used a swastika that was once German land, right? Which is all of Eurasia.
Tibet, North America. Yeah. Oh, well, there's one more element that is tied with the anti-democratic, like the conscious opposition to the notion of democracy, is the Führer principle, or the Caudillo,
Caudillismo,
or the Duce, or whatever. Like that's what is a defining feature of fascism, is that in the
right,
the one great leader.
Yeah, in opposition to the idea of competing communities in you know, sort of managed and arbitrated by the state in the form of a parliament. They instead have the representation of the entire will of the race or the nation, it's all channeled through, like a particularly exceptional person, like a Superman.
Right. Well, I mean that does seem to sort of, I don't know, flow from the idea of a sort of uniformity of the people, right? Like of the unity of the people, that you don't need a multiplicity represented. You need a perfect ideal to lead.
Right, because that's the best we can all hope for as individuals anyways, is to aspire to the ideal.
So the Mussolini modeled himself as being like first consul, you know, of the Roman Republic, the new Roman Republic, the new Roman Empire. But he was removed by the fascist council when the Allies invaded Sicily. That's how he was deposed, was the fascist council was like, look, you're out. You know, you're no longer... I'm sure he could have, if he wanted to, have made a fight and had a civil war within Italy for control of the government. But I think he had lost the confidence of his party and his country at that point. But that, however, did not exist in Nazi Germany. Hitler was autocrat. Hitler was the state, you know, in very much like the French king would have been, you know.
Well, it's like there's two different versions of Napoleon. There's Napoleon as first consul and Napoleon as emperor. I mean, like, I feel like I've also come across a lot in left-wing discourse of basically a conflation of Bonapartism with fascism, or that, or rather that the political roots of fascism, and I think this is something I'm prepared to accept, that the political roots of fascism are in the French Revolution just as much as the political roots of the modern workers' movement and its ideology, and its politics of socialism.
Yeah, well, I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah, the French Revolution birthed the modern world in all of its contradictions.
Yeah.
There's always within fascism a cult of tradition, radical traditionalism. Like the idea that exists with it. It's all within the palingenesis thing, you know, that modernity is evil and the traditional way that we have always done things was good and we need to go back to it, you know. On top of that is sort of like triumph of the will, that the idea that you can use your will to, or the national will, you know, to break through any obstacle, the will of the people, the will of the race, the will of the nation, can overcome material conditions. I mean, it's anti-materialist. Fascism is anti-materialist.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that worked out really well for Hitler whenever he was using the will of the German people to oppose the massive Russian onslaught, where he would order armies into existence and order these phantom armies into battle. And his generals would just be like, Jawohl, mein Führer, and retreated across the Russian steppes.
This is all like a pretty good exposition of what fascism is historically, and you can extrapolate it everywhere, and you can find similarities and differences to some degree in South America, various kind of hyper-nationalist movements in the Middle East,
right,
Southeast Asia, whatever.
Like, a lot of the national revolutionary movements have elements of what we would consider fascism, you know, like the Ba'athists.
I was going to say, actually, people talk about Bashar al-Assad as a... Doesn't his regime bear a lot of the similarities and characteristics of what we traditionally have referred to as fascism? But, like, it seems like the more strictly you define fascism, the harder it is to find examples of it, right? Like, the difference between Estado Novo in Portugal, Franco in Spain, and Vichy France, that's all the same part of Europe. But they're almost as different as they are similar.
Mm-hmm. Right. They all have their own national character.
Of course, it's necessarily going to be different in at least some regards. Some aspects are going to reflect the cultural traditions of a particular place or time. But it seems to me that brings two questions to the fore of how many elements can be stripped away before something stops being fascism. That's one question, and then a second question is, are there any elements that are more essential that cannot be stripped away and it still be called fascism?
One of the things I would like to do real quick before we get into that is just talk about fascism in practice, and I'll make this quick because I just want to talk about some of the things that we talked about at the very beginning as being the principles of fascism, and specifically, what I would like to deal with are the economic aspects of fascism. In principle, what changed in Mussolini's Italy was nothing much economically. The relationship the relationship of workers to bosses stayed almost exactly the same. There was some improvement in the fortunes of workers initially, but that all went away, specifically after the war started. And the same goes for Nazi Germany as well. At the very beginning, there were these programs to, like the Volkswagen, you know, mm-hmm. we're going to create an affordable car so that every German can have a car. That never got off the ground because Hitler was not willing to take the money from the rich or take the money away from the military.
Well, like, the Volkswagen never even went into production until after the end of the Third Reich, right?
A gigantic factory was built to produce Volkswagens and ended up being used for producing war materials instead. There was a program to put a radio in every house, right? There were internal settlement programs for veterans of the SA and stuff like that, so that people could own their own plot of land and farm it. And they built these incredibly shitty houses with no electricity and no plumbing and stuff like that. So there was like lip service towards the idea that the people were going to be taken care of, specifically the working classes are going to be taken care of. But what the Nazis did when they got into power is they, and same with the fascists, is they crushed the labor unions. They arrested wages so that they couldn't raise anymore. They every once in a while arbitrated labor disputes on behalf of the workers, but only ever very rarely, because Hitler made a deal with the ruling class in order to take power. And that is one of the things that I think is really important to remember about fascism, is that in practice, what fascism is the utilization of mass politics for the first time in history toward the maintenance of the status quo. Well, think of it more like this, like the utilization of the mass party.
Right. Okay. That is a distinction, like mass political forms.
Like the utilization of mass political forms for the maintenance of reactionary purposes.
Right, so the party press, the street militia, the mass rally.
Exactly.
Those were all only ever threats to the social order until fascism.
God.
So we've got our skeleton of fascism.
That fucking, fucking things fit in my brain. That makes sense.
Yeah. It's sort of like you're like, what the hell is fascism? It does it actually even mean anything? You're like, well, here you go.
Yeah.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
Right. Because whenever you see whenever you get a meme with like a picture of Hitler and a picture of Donald Trump, and it's like, said rude things, also says rude things. hated immigrants, also hated immigrants. Was, you know, really loved the army, you know, like, and you're like, wait, this doesn't help clarify anything.
No, not at all. But let's get back to what Kevin was just asking us about. How many elements can you strip away from something before it stops being fascism, right?
And are there any particular elements of fascism in particular that cannot be stripped from it?
Right. And I would say the things that cannot be stripped away from fascism in order for it to still be fascism, the most important thing out of that list that we just came up with is the utilization of the mass party, you know, mass political forms. That is the most important, to me anyway, in my opinion, the most important element of fascism. Second would be the utilization of left-wing rhetoric for right-wing causes, you know, so like, anti-capitalism, you know,
right,
like you said.
Yeah,
which I think that's great. I actually really like that stuff like that. So those are two things that I think that separate fascism from other right-wing authoritarianisms,
right? Like,
because
if a military coup reestablishes a monarchy, and the monarchy is repressive and conservative and traditionalist, and it finds no mass expression in the popular will, then it's not all that different than basically every government in the world prior to the Age of Revolutions, right? Like, it's not, it bears no distinct features which would mark it as like fascist as opposed to, you know,
mm-hmm. right,
any other traditional government, from the French Ancien Régime all the way to like the whatever, every single old monarchy in Europe.
Gotcha. And that would make a distinction between right-wing authoritarian and fascism sensible, because you strip away the mass party aspect of fascism, and you're left with right-wing authoritarianism. And so that there's a cogent distinction to be made.
But it's not that they don't have a natural affinity for each other, right? Like in Spain, Franco comes to power at the head of an alliance of fascists, monarchists, and other sort of like Catholic supremacist forces. It's not like not at all like the Nazis, which are, it's the Nazi movement as a mass movement that takes power.
Well, you know, even with the fascists in Italy, it's a coalition of monarchists, conservatives, and fascists that take power. And without the support of those other parts of that coalition, Mussolini was not able to stay in power, you know.
So it's kind of like left unity, only it's at the right, and it actually happens.
That's one of the things that is often said that always holds true, is that the right knows how to engage in class solidarity, right?
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that Enzo Traverso says about Donald Trump specifically, it's speaking about whether or not Trump being rude to Hillary makes him a fascist, you know, is that Trump is a TV star that attracts an audience in an atomized society of consumers. He doesn't command his party and his street militias. And that's one of the key things that differentiates Trump from the fascists. But he does say that Trump and his ilk come from out of the fascist matrix, right?
Yeah, because, I mean, I feel like what Trump is missing in that rendition of him is not so much a lack of his own will to command a party structure, nor even a lack of a will that among his followers that he command a party structure, but rather the lack of a party structure that
right.
follows
that's,
his command.
That's really well put, actually.
Yeah.
Which is to say that it's a theoretical possibility at some future date.
Oh, yeah. That's another thing Traverso says, is that post-fascism is a mutating form that could take another form in the near future. We just don't know what it is yet, because it's constantly changing everywhere.
Right, like, you know? Like the fact that the Front National can pose themselves as, that can present themselves as the defenders of republicanism and of republican values in France against the anti-democratic impulses of Islam. Like, that's not there's nothing traditionally fascist about that. Like, it's the opposite, even. You know, the French fascists would say, like, it's the Republican periods in our history. I mean, traditionally, historically, the Republican periods in our history are unstable, and the periods of dictatorship or monarchy are stable, and that's good. But the Front National says, oh yeah, we're Republicans just like everybody else. That's just like one of many key distinct features of traditional fascism that's just absent entirely.
So fascism came into existence as the radical right-wing answer to Bolshevism, right? We have no more Bolshevism. One of the things that Traverso says is that post-USSR capitalism, so what we would refer to as late capitalism or neoliberal capitalism, is capitalism without a human face.
Mm. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Nice, yeah.
It's brutal. It's atomizing, it's alienating in a way that it never had been before. But anyway, so
it also lacks any sense of progress, right? Like right. Modernism as an ideological outgrowth of the particular mechanisms of industrial capitalism, that's all absent. So there is no
right.
you're not even raised with, or you're raised less and less with, and it's certainly less it's not omnipresent, the progress I mean, I don't know. I guess it's still there. Like, you still have, like, technocrats like Elon Musk who, you know, the machines are going to save us or whatever.
Yeah, but it's not...
And calls himself a socialist.
Right. Well...
But it's not any kind of... It's like machines are going to save our species, not like machines are going to give us all a better life. You know
right,
what
it's
I mean?
It's not the enlightenment. It's not the elevation of the human spirit to ever, ever greater heights in perpetuity. Toward
right, that's dead.
Increasing degrees of perfection, at you know, and at the cost of tradition, which is like that's the thing that marks modernism as an ethic or whatever.
So, if there is no Bolshevism, and capitalism has the freedom to be as brutal as it needs to be, then is there a need for mass fascist parties anymore when we've got atomized fascism?
Right.
Post-fascism.
Somebody said to me that recently that the modern American alt-right are like, you know, they're trying to be really clever by making reference to Pinochet rather than to Hitler, you know. And they would always talk about helicopter rides or whatever, and that's like dog whistle stuff that, like, you know, they... And I actually think it might be actually a more conscious ideological affinity for a conscious, like, free market neoliberal society, which is also viciously anti-woman, doesn't acknowledge gender outside of binary, viciously anti-communist. But it's, like, also... And it's authoritarian, and it's fascistic in its methodology, but it also doesn't purport to have... to harmonize the classes. There's no corporatist element. It's just the neoliberal free market nightmare that was Pinochet's Chile is very much embraced by the modern American right. They just also don't want to, you know, use people's pronouns, and they're also terrified of organized labor. Or even though it's like at its least terrifying it's ever been.
Every single last alt-righter that was old enough to know who Ron Paul was voted for Ron Paul in the, you know, the 2008 elections,
right.
You know,
and that doesn't
like all of these alt-righters, if they didn't come just straight out of, you know, Call of Duty and 4chan, came from the libertarian movement, you know, and that's not even an exaggeration. Like,
not at all. Not
the
alt-right
is full of former libertarians. I mean, and also some people who still profess to be libertarians.
Yeah.
So these libertarians are totally willing to give up their ideas of, you know, freedom for stability and, you know, the homos being thrown out of helicopters. You
right.
know what I mean?
I mean, it's still because there's still economic freedom in the sense that nobody's going to stop you accumulating wealth if you're ruthless and psychopathic enough to do so.
Right.
But that's all they really mean by freedom. And, like, this is why I don't think this is a semantic difference. Like, I actually think it's political clarity on this is important. But when other people on the left say, why say the word alt-right? They're fascists. A fascist is a fascist, is a Nazi is a fascist. And it's like, well, it's probably worth trying to analyze the characteristics of this new movement, if only because we might have to counter it in a different way than the old movement. Because it's a different thing.
Because it's a different thing.
But I do think it's probably telling that the same people that tend to say that also tend to be the same people who imagine that we've worked out like a plan for how to get from capitalism to some sort of post-capitalist society that we might call communism or whatever. And then we already worked it out. We merely have to like graft on that historical experience onto our present moment. It's the same inability to...
Just role play.
Yeah.
Yeah, role play October 1917 over and over again until
we get it right. Our enemies apparently are going to do the same thing, right? That's what we expect.
We really have to stop, or not we, like, not the three of
Kevin
us,
in particular.
People on the left really have to stop being confounded by the idea that there are Mexicans that are Proud Boys. You
right.
know?
Oh, yeah.
Like there, yeah. Or that there are Jews who are a part of the alt-right.
Yeah, or that, like, like anti-Semitism is not even a defining feature of post-fascism in a lot of countries.
Right.
Because...
Well, like, the United States is not.
There wasn't a State of Israel before the end of the Second World War.
Well, right, exactly. Anti-Semitism itself being a focus of the original movement of fascism was an intrinsic. It's not like a particular hatred of this particular group of people that defines fascism. It was that this was a group of people in their particular world, in that particular place, in that particular time, and you uproot the same political impetus from that particular place and time, put it in a different place and time, and of course its ire is going to be focused elsewhere. It's going to look at, it's going to have different enemies. It's going to have different impurities to cleanse from the face of the earth than the ones that were
right.
It was focused
like in
on
this
before.
Country, it's Arabs, and in Israel, it's Arabs.
In this country and in Europe.
Right.
Well, and
even,
in Europe, it's
even
Arabs.
More so than Arabs in this country, it's Latin American immigrants.
Well, yeah. Especially now.
Yeah.
Like, especially in this
moment
in particular.
Let's not get it twisted, though. There are actual Nazis and fascists that are part of the alt-right.
Yeah, of course.
Right. And real anti-Semitism absolutely
But they're the same as Maoists in the DSA. They exist, but they're nowhere near like hegemonic or even particularly influential. What they are is representatives, like sort of personifications of an old politics that haven't been fully worked into the new yet.
Right. So the alt-right tries to distance itself from Nazis and outright fascists. Whenever it has to speak in public, you know, the Proud Boys claim to be against racism and not to let in members of, you know, anti-Semitic organizations, or not to let in people who are Nazis.
Right, like you can't have like a swastika tattoo on your forehead and join the Proud Boys.
Right.
Yeah, a prominent Proud Boy up here in Portland is Tiny Tim, this big, big fucking guy who I think he's like Pacific Islander or something like that.
Yeah.
And he's like, he is the one who has been witnessed laying out random people, even outside of rallies, and being the most confrontational at rallies. I think that they all sort of like, I think that they get together and they talk about that. They do that on purpose.
Absolutely.
They agree that he's going to be the most aggressive one. Cause who's going to, white guilt liberal Portlander is going to bow up against
a person
of color
who is explicitly not a racist. It says, I hate racists. You know, and we're like, oh, we're only equipped to do one thing here. I don't know how to combat this, because this guy doesn't look like the bonehead that I sort of imagine everybody with right-wing politics to look like and act like.
So when you look at Trump and you look at his rhetoric and you look at everything that he's attempting to do, how is he different from Herbert Hoover?
He's not. except for that he calls himself a nationalist. Just now, he decided to adopt the term nationalist, which I'm really happy about, because I think it just helps us. I think it helps it make it easier for us to make
it.
Like, well, nationalists are bad. People who are trying to defend
Absolutely.
The integrity of the nation.
Clarifies the fault lines.
Socialists over here, the good guys, and nationalists over here, bad guys. But in reality, like, Donald Trump's much more like every American president ever than any, like, objectively self-styled fascist dictator anywhere.
Well, I mean, like, I don't know enough about American history to go back and name every single president that's ever said, I'm a nationalist. But I know that nationalism has been used as a tool throughout the history of the United States.
Absolutely. Even if a particular president hasn't necessarily used that exact word, I don't think that that's really innovation.
No. Actually, you know, Trump is probably more like Woodrow Wilson than he is like Herbert Hoover, because he's an aggressive foreign policy hawk who is a nationalist at home, and he wants to promote American values abroad. and he's very cozy with the reactionaries of his day. Wilson being, you know, friendly with the Ku Klux Klan, and Donald Trump being increasingly
friendly with the Ku Klux Klan,
new sort of resurgent movement of the right.
So, I mean, that isn't to say that a new Wilson, Wilsonian, or like Herbert Hoover presidency isn't a complete and utter fucking nightmare.
Right.
That should be opposed at all costs. It's just not fucking fascism.
So that's why I found Traverso saying, using the term post-fascist matrix, so right. useful. Because here we are, like, struggling to figure out exactly how we can sort of, like, fit Trump into some historical trajectory, and it actually yet remains to be seen what the ultimate consequences of the Trump presidency will be. Like, post-fascism is maybe a little bit more articulate in Europe, you know, in yeah. Hungary.
Right, because, I mean, it's a political parties that literally grew out of the same groups of people getting together who used to be the right. the actual and fascists.
These are also countries with the recent history, tragic history, of having been horrendously mismanaged by parties of the left. So, like, you don't have a Front National in France that gains prominence without successive failed socialist governments which applied austerity and decimated the welfare state and took away, it shattered the identity of the Socialist Party as a representative of the workers. So then you, right, because of that, then you can have the fascists swoop in and take on that mantle. In this country, we have only had right-wing administrations for a very long time, and we have no... Whatever, we have further to... we don't have as far to fall, so I don't think our reaction's quite as sharply yeah. defined yet.
Right.
What appears is all that is true, and what is true is what appears. This allusion to the Society of the Spectacle.
Yeah. Nice.
In this article by Gaspar Miklós Tamás.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He talked about the Blair Project as the most extreme version of socialism means capitalism, you know? Social justice means privatization and a big brother kind of existence. Everything means its opposite.
Kevin's yeah. laughing because he sees me trying to not make a Blair Witch Project joke.
So, I mean, what you have the socialist parties of Europe stepping in and becoming the parties of austerity and neoliberalism. And you have people associating the declining living standards and decline in accessibility to healthcare and everything like that with socialist parties, right? And then you've also still got the negative baggage of Stalinism.
Right, I was going to say this is doubly true in Eastern Europe, where, like, right. you have the collapse of the Warsaw Pact governments, and then a period of horrendous instability and austerity, which then brought the left back to power in some form or another in most of these countries for at least part of their yeah. recent history, only to have that be the new hammer by which they were again bludgeoned. So you have, like, the yeah. dual trauma of being betrayed by the communists and the social democrats, and so there's no other left. There's no third left. Unless you want to go to a punk rock show and, you know, eat vegan food and, like, that's fun or whatever, but it's not a model of government.
So, one of the things that gives me, that lessens my, doesn't say give me hope, but...
Strike that word from your vocabulary.
I don't have that, but just sort of lessens my fear and dread of impending fascism is the idea that these new sort of post-fascist groupings don't have anything else other than business as usual when it comes to how to solve economic problems.
Well, for now, anyways.
Right. What, yeah, for now.
Business as usual, but a harsher line on, more rigidly nationalistic, and a harsher line on more of an emphasis on revanchism, like entrenching social reactionary, I don't want to use the word privilege, but like playing into and tapping into people's terror at losing what little they have left, which is their social position of superiority over other other people who don't share their particular identity, right? Like a straight, cis straight white man who's been in the Midwest and addicted to opioids and disabled from a work injury, and he's addicted to opioids because of that, and he lives on disability. He is at the bottom of the social heap, but the one thing he's got, is that he's at least got that, like, he is the man that Trump is talking to and saying right. that America is yours. It's not theirs. They're coming to take it from you. And that America is going to get a lot fucking worse in the meantime, and can get a lot fucking worse. For the people right. at its margins.
Yeah, I mean, I was mostly just referring to, like, Europe. Like, America's fucked.
Right.
Like, I think that the European social democratic parties that are pulling back to the left and sort of trying to scoop back in the members that have left and started forming groupings of anti-capitalists that are anti-austerity, and that there might be some sort of, you know, lessening of the appeal of the far right in places where an economic alternative is offered, say like in the UK with Corbyn or in France with Mélenchon.
Right. And I think like in this country, because we just have a dumber version of everything, because everything's less politically clear and articulate. Like when the next recession happens, like when the stock market crashes and when this tendency of governments around the world to like ditch the dollar as its primary, trading currency in favor of the euro, which is wild, or stockpiling gold or whatever. But when the recession comes to this country, at the level of mass politics, the phenomenon, Kevin, that you're talking about, which is terrifying, even though it hasn't yet found itself expressed fully in like fascist street militia or whatever. But you pair that with the demagoguery and like utter lack of any serious political convictions, and you could imagine it's very easily a situation in which Donald Trump just responds to that by saying, "Oh yeah, here's what we're going to do now." And post-fascism does become a lot more articulate and much more akin to what we would, for the sake of expediency, would be comfortable calling fascism. And yet we don't have a corresponding left. There's no counter-hegemony in the form of, like, a labor movement tied to a left, like there is in France. For all the problems with the right. with the Communist Party of France or whatever, its historic relationship to the trade unions means that it is still a workers' party, and it is still capable, potentially, of responding to a far-right threat with a mass mobilization of the workers.
Right, whereas the American labor movement purged all of its communist leaders... and the right. McCarthy era.
Or, you know, like in Brazil right now with the Bolsonaro and all of the horrors implicit in that possibility. The flip side of it, of course, is that you've had like 20 years of the development of social mobilization and expression of mass politics, even in really distorted forms, like with the Workers' Party of Lula, that you can conceive of a contest between what we can call post-fascism and a genuine workers' movement of the left. In this country, like Chris, like you said, it's all much more horrifying. Even though it's not as pronounced right now, but when it is, it's also more so.
So one of the things that Traverso said that I thought might be worth mentioning is that humanity needs utopias. So there will be more revolutions, there will be more mass movements because humanity needs utopias to survive, right?
Yeah.
But who says humanity is going to survive?
Oh, God.
Maybe we just never get our utopias and then we don't survive.
Well, and you know, not all utopias are left-wing utopias, right?
What does a right-wing utopia look like in the United States? A right-wing utopia in the United States is... one in which, and let's not get ridiculous and say, in which all the black people are kicked out and all the Mexicans are kicked back across the border, because no one's even calling for that. What they're calling for is the propping up of a system that already exists and the strengthening of that system. Well, it's white supremacy at the top with a permanent underclass of, you know, brown people that allow for poor white people to be paid less. You know, I mean, it's just the strengthening of the system that already exists.
I mean,
exists.
It's the 1920s. What it is it's a period of unregulated accumulation of wealth and concentrations of power of horrendous excess with, you know, like a surplus population of people who don't fit into the sort of racial hierarchy, or they fit very, they feature very low on the scale of the racial hierarchy, and they do like terrible, shitty jobs. And society is primarily like officially it's socially conservative, but like if you're wealthy, you can, you know, and you and your Yale Boys Club can get up to whatever shenanigans you want to get up to, right? Because it's a utopia for like wealthy white people. And that's, you know, when Donald Trump talks about making America great again, and we all talk about these like visions of the world that they want to go back to. We always say the 1950s. I actually think it's probably more like it's the period after white supremacy is reasserted. The defeat of
Reconstruction. No one wants to go back to the 1950s with a, you know, income tax rate for the top 1%. It's like 90%.
Right, and the country's perpetually threatened by a Cold War nemesis, although they do want that with China or whatever.
Well, I don't know if that's entirely true. I think that a lot of the, like, how many times have you seen people on the internet making fun of people at, you know, Tea Party rallies or whatever with a sign saying, keep your government hands off my Medicare and Social Security? Like, I think that they do look at going back to the 1950s with high tax rates on the top income bracket and expansive social welfare programs. And I think the movements behind things like the Tea Party and Donald Trump absolutely do favor those sorts of things. It's the policies that they get as a reward for their support certainly aren't those things. But I think the movement behind them is.
That's true.
Yeah, I mean,
I was thinking more of the ruling class.
Point. We should mark a distinction. This is the thing, like, because there is no like mass fascist movement and party, and there is only this atomized, diffuse reaction. It does look a lot like desperate poor people being taken advantage of by, you know, populist rich people, they do have different visions of the world. The desperate poor white people, or the moderately well off white people who are afraid of being like the desperate poor white people more than anything. Yeah, you're right. They have a vision of a harmonious society. They feature most prominently.
That's why so many Trump supporters said, "Well, I would have voted for Bernie if he would have won," because he's saying things about the working class that people.
Well, and like
hear.
If you don't have an analysis of fascism as being basically the consequence of an inability of the left to like capture the momentum, then when you hear a Trump supporter say, "I would have voted for Bernie," you might make the mistake of thinking that means that Bernie Sanders is bad.
Yeah, you might end up being a complete fucking dipshit and saying that, see, Bernie Sanders supporters are reactionaries.
That rests on this is something we talked about the last time we all got together, which is this relocation of politics down to the level of the individual rather than the mass. So, like, this person's politics are bad, so this person's bad. Rather than recognizing the reality of social dynamics being that things move and that people move in groups back and forth. And you can have a situation in which, you know, somebody who had voted for the PSAF in the last several elections might vote for Le Pen now. And that they might not next time, right? They might, that their vote can switch back and forth from being a pro-communist vote to a pro-fascist vote.
Or that AfD's in Germany's largest geographic area of support is in the former Eastern Bloc.
Been dominated by Die Linke for a while until it's not dominated, but like that there's like Die Linke's vote share has shrunk corresponding with that of, I don't know the name of the German far right party.
It's AfD in English.
It's like the Democrats.
It's
Alternative for Germany.
Alternative for Germany.
Right.
Alternative für Deutschland. So, to sum up,
fascism is bad.
Anywhere where the left has,
but importantly, actual fascism is bad.
Yeah, actual fascism is bad. Actual fascism is the worst. the post-fascist milieu, the post-fascist matrix, from which Trump supporters and the right-wing parties of Europe are also bad. And I don't want to see what they develop
right,
into.
Smash them
so
while they're
smash
only the
them
second
now.
Worst.
And so, okay, so to sum up, in places where there is some sort of left alternative, we don't have much to fear from fascism. In places where there is a weak and vacillating or lack of a left alternative, we've got something to fear from the far right, you know. So the United States, we've got something to fear from the far right. And I don't think a blue wave is going to solve anything.
No, may make it worse.
Right. There is reason to fear, my friends.